Okay. I'm first going to ask you some really simple demographic questions.
Okay.
And these questions may jog your memory about from stories, mm-hmm. but as we said at the beginning, we want you to save them till the appropriate time. Okay. I'll let you know. And then we can go into more detail that later. So, for right now, would you please say and spell your name for me?
Charles Morris, CharlesMorris.
What is your date of birth, including the year?
1/28/1938.
And how old are you?
79.
How would you describe your ethnic background?
Oh, let's see. Catholic, Black, Irish, Jewish, and Scottish.
Okay.
First Nation.
First Nation? Okay.
Yeah, it's Seminole on my great-great-grandmother's side.
What is your religion?
Basically, I tell people I do not support a ministry.
Okay.
But after that, everything is the same. I mean, I always, when I start a prayer, I says, I'll say now, as because of my history, I'll say now to the Great Spirit, God, thank you. And from whatever it is I'm talking, you know, speaking of,
okay. You know. What is the highest level of formal education you've completed?
I need 1 or 2 more hours to graduate from Eastern.
From Eastern, okay.
Yeah. And I got an associate degree from Washington.
Did you attend any additional school or career training beyond that?
I went to school in the Navy as an electronics technician, and I just did some refresher courses in carpentry and electrical work at Washington Community College.
What is your marital status?
I'm married.
How many children do you have?
One boy. One. I should say one grown man.
So. What was your primary occupation, your main occupation?
It was basically, what I retired from was a library and a library clerk, and I was bookmobile driver and driver trainer.
No, we'll learn more about that later.
Yeah.
And what age did you retire?
65 and 2 months, I think. It was, I think that's what they had at the time, 65 years and 2 months. And so it was roughly 65 years and 2 months.
Okay, now I'm going to ask you some questions about your memory of your childhood and your youth. Even if these questions jog your memory again about other items in your life, please only respond with the memories for this part of it.
That okay.
About, okay? What was your family like when you were a child?
I don't know how to really answer that. All I could say is that I think that I was raised by a family that made me realize that nobody was more special than you for their color or their religion, and I was not special, more special than anybody else yeah. because of mine. And I think that's the way I was raised. And we were kind of at one time, because my mother's family was all Catholic, raised in Louisiana, so I started out in a Catholic school. My dad went to the Methodist Church, a half a block one way from the house, and my mother went to the Baptist church a half a block from the house the other way. So we had three different churches, and there was no conflict. Because it was all about, it was one, I was there because that's where I was supposed to go as far as the family history. And the other was that, as long as God don't care where you pray, it's how you live, so.
What sort of work did your parents do?
My dad was a painter for the Ypsilanti school system. He was the painter for the Ypsilanti school system. And my mother was a beautician. And he, but before that, he was, he worked in the bomber plant during the Second World War. And he was also an air raid warden during the Second World War. So that a lot of people don't realize we had air raids in this area because of that bomber plant out there. So that you had to, basically what you did was we went to the neighbor's house to listen to the war news while my dad and a guy named L.C. Perry, who was a member of the, he was a dentist, he was our family dentist, he was also a member of the Ipsy School Board, and his son was All-American Men at Michigan, Lowell Perry, who was one of my neighbors. So,
were there any special days, events, or family traditions you remember when you were a child?
Basically, we just had the Christmas dinners We went to Christmas dinner in Detroit, and we had basically Thanksgiving dinner at home. And then as my family got a little more money, got our own house and stuff like, then some of the dinners would be at our house and the other ones would be at Detroit at another family member for the holidays. So we always, it was always a family event, Thanksgiving and Christmas. New Year's was kind of private. Yeah.
And you were in Ypsilanti, right?
Yeah.
How were the holidays traditionally celebrated? Well, you've told me a little bit about how you traveled back and forth. Some people went to this house and that house.
It was basically in Detroit, and we would go to either one of my aunt's houses in Detroit, and or at our house here in Ypsilanti. So usually since it was just us, we usually went there in the good weather, in the bad weather, usually in the winter, and they came out, especially 4th of July. My mother would always have a 4th of July barbecue. So all the family from Detroit would be out for that. And that was a big event. Especially the fresh churned peached ice cream. That was.
How long were you in Ypsilanti?
How long?
Yeah.
Well, from my first birthday on, we came here in '39, I think.
Okay. You've already told me that you completed all but one course at Eastern. So did you go to high school in Ypsilanti? I'm asking the highest.
Yeah, I went there. And because I was interested in model airplanes and stuff like that, you had two courses. You had a general course and you had a college prep course. And my dad says, you're going to take the college prep course. And I says, what if I don't want to go to college? He says, I don't care. You're going to know more if you take the college prep course. And I said, yes, sir.
And that was at Ipsy High?
Yeah. And then you had the regular college prep course, and then you had the architecture and engineering. And that required, you had plane geometry, you had math, and then you had algebra for 2 years, and then your senior year, the first semester was trigonometry, and the second semester was solid geometry. And you had to take 4 years of English, and a foreign language. And I got my, I still have somewhere my student handbook that a friend of mine, Levi Simpson, who was the graduated from Eastern and was the track coach at Ipsy for years, and he borrowed it from me because I got one before he graduated, so he had one. He used my book till he graduated and gave it back to me because he was a couple years ahead of me, see.
Okay, okay.
So he, but I looked at my son's guidebook and I looked on there and I couldn't find those classes that I was looking for. I was looking for the algebra, I was looking for the English, I was looking for, you know, the subjects that I knew were did really help, even though you didn't think it at the time. And I couldn't find them in the curriculum. And I said, now, there's something wrong here. And my buddy who took, he went, the general course at Ipsy High School was one or two classes different than the college prep. I don't care, if you took stenography, you're only one or two classes different than if you took a regular college prep course. So your whole education system seemed to have been graded higher than it is today. They keep trying to fix it when it was never broke. You just got to have the courses in place and the teachers in place. That's a question later, though, I think.
That's fine. That's interesting, since there was so much conversation about the differences in the curriculum in terms of students achieving. And so you say that there were only a couple courses different than the general
and the college prep program. See, architecture and engineering, you had to take two sciences, and only in your head, so you had to take either, well, you took chemistry, and you took, what the heck I'm trying to think of, is, and you use it all the time, what, oh heck, I can't say it right now.
Physics,
right. Yeah, chemistry, you couldn't take biology because it wasn't a science. In the same sense of what physics and chemistry is. And the thing is, those things you use all your life.
Now, in talking about the differences in the curriculum today as opposed to when you were in school, can you tell me any other differences in your school experience when you were there and the school experience today?
Well, I can't, what I'm seeing and not being in the classroom, being there, is that the more emphasis is on passing a test than learning the skills in math or physics or whatever that can really help you. You know, and I think one of the advantages that I think we had, and I'm saying the guys, all the people on the South Side that went to Harris Street Elementary, those teachers made sure you could do three things. You could read, you could write, and you could count. See, so you might not have had all the other advantages, but competition-wise in the classroom, you had all the tools you needed.
Did you play any sports or get involved in any other extracurricular activities?
I played football and ran track. And I couldn't make the basketball team. Mm-hmm. And I didn't think about going out for wrestling because that would have probably been the only other sport. And so I managed the basketball team and the wrestling team in different seasons. And I became closer to the wrestlers because even though it's a team sport, it's an individual effort on the mat. So they had a greater respect because they knew what each one of them had to go through when they walked out on that mat by themselves. So they were a closer knit team than most of your regular teams, you know.
So you were in sports almost all year round if you were.
That's what, that was the name of it. That's what you did back then. And the coaches did that. They wanted you active because you were in shape all the time. And the wrestling coach used to, anybody that wrestled in the lower weights ran cross country, and all the ones in the heavier weights played football.
So. Did you enjoy them? Did you like them?
Yes, yeah.
Kept you out of trouble and busy?
It did more than that. It kept your grades up.
Kept your grades up.
Because you had to have a 2 point all year. You didn't have, you couldn't be, if you dipped below a 2 point in the winter, you didn't run track or play baseball or tennis or any other sport. So you had to be eligible year round. And you had to be eligible at the end of the year in order to compete next year. So
you went on to Eastern from there, or did you go right
after school? No, I went to Fair State for a year, and then I knew I wasn't ready for college. My dad was trying to get me to go back a year. I said, no, I'm going to try to find a job, and then I'll figure out what I want to do. And that was in January, and from January till I joined the Navy in August that year, couldn't find a job. And because of the times, you could apply for a job and the job would still be running a month later as unfilled, so naturally you knew why you didn't get hired. And but my dad, he said, all he said was okay, because he wanted me to see what it was like to try to get a job with nothing going for you other than your high school diploma. And but that 1 year of college did more for me than if I hadn't gone at all. So what I advise a lot of young men and women nowadays is go to Washington, get a year or two in, and it'll help you later. Whether you go any further or not, it'll help you later. Because what happened that 1 year when I enlisted in the Navy, I enlisted as a, well, I got a 91 or 92 at the recruiter. And then we had to take another battery test at Fort Wayne, and I got a 90-something there. And when I went in the Navy, in all forces, you have your entry exams where they check you, you know, and see what your aptitude might be. And then you have your main battery of tests. And they test you on your communication skills, math skills, basic mechanics, and all of that. And then from there, you qualify for your, you can, what you can, what we call strike for, what you can try to be. And I requalified in electronic fields again, because the only thing I was average in, everything else I was above average in, and I credit that to my dad making me go to school that first year. And the only thing I was averaging was sonar, and that was listening to the different signals to tell the difference between them, to be able to separate the dots and dashes, because some of them are blurred, slurred, or something like that. Some are real quick, and I only got averaging that. So when I got ready to try for a field, you had a choice of three. You drew three in the same field. So it was either electronics technician, which is what we call the Black Shoe Navy. That's the people that go aboard ship. And aviation electrician, electronics technician, those are the guys that work with the Air Force. And sonar, which I knew I wasn't going to get because I was only average in sonar. So I went to the aviation electronic technician school from after that.
So how long were you in the Navy?
4 years, and I did 2 years in the reserve.
And then you came back, and that's when you went to Eastern?
No, I went to Eastern. A couple other buddies of mine that got to serve at the same time. We went to Henry Ford for maybe a year, and then they opened up Washington Community College. And when they opened that up, It was the greatest thing I ever saw in this city. People that you never thought would ever be trying to get better than they were ahead of you in line, going back to school to get another chance. And that was probably one of the greatest events in Ypsilanti, as far as I'm concerned, that it really got people back on their feet and another chance at a shot that you didn't have, because there was no, Eastern was a teacher's college, and most people who graduated from high school didn't have, you had to have almost a B average or better to be considered to go to Eastern. So when they opened up the community college, mm-hmm. here we come.
Yeah. How old were you then?
When I got out of service, I went in, I was 22 when I went in, so I was 26 when I got out.
Were there any changes in your family life during the time, during your school years?
No.
Yes, your mom and dad were?
Yeah, we did. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, my dad always told me something I fell short in, he would just look at me and he says, "You know what you got to do?" And I'd say, "Yes, sir." He'd say, "Okay, that's it." So it always broke down, and then all the way through my life, I knew if I wanted to get it done, then I had to know what to do. Yeah.
Now, when thinking back on your school years, what important social or historical events were taking place at that time, and how did they personally affect you, if any, and your family?
Well, basically the family, I can't think, what I'm saying is I don't know specifically, actually there were no drastic changes during that time, except until I'd probably say after from 1960 on, did you start to become aware of what was going on in the South and in the North. Because a lot of things we grew up in, everything we needed was on the South Side. The grocery stores were there, the dry cleaners was there, the soda fountain was there. Everything was on the South Side if you needed it. You did your major stuff like clothing and most of your big time shopping you did downtown. But other than that, we're basically self-contained on the South Side.
So when you say that, are you talking about African American?
Yeah, on the South Side.
And so there were, you said, cleaners and?
Yeah, man, everything was there, you know. The only time you really didn't realize it, because you didn't had no problem going to anything downtown. You didn't know, you just went. Mm-hmm. And later on, I learned like places that my family and friends of mine couldn't go to downtown. It affected you later in life when you realized, well, wait a minute, you know. You go through school together, you do everything with the whole system, mm-hmm. you know. There was, because I was in the sports, and Ed Chafford was the athletic director at the time, and there was a picture of one of the 1940s football teams, and right in the center of the front row was a Chinese kid that played varsity football for Ypsilanti High School in the 40s. And that just kind of set your whole mindset about your school, mm-hmm. you know. So it's like almost like an insulator, because you did everything together in school, but you didn't know until you walked out of school and started going to try to get a job or something like that, you know. Because in our generation, we weren't expected to go to college. We were expected to look for a job. And what any time you went to college, it was such, to some people it was a surprise, and to other people it was expected, because you had shown some potential and you ought to use it. So it made But the transition really didn't come until after you really got away from Ypsilanti and saw the rest of the world. And then you get a more mature mindset of what's going on around you.
So did the civil rights activities of the 60s impact your family at all?
In Ypsilanti, it was, we didn't have to take giant steps. In Ann Arbor, you didn't have to take giant steps, but you had to take steps. Mm-hmm. When you get all your bases except for boot camp was in San Diego for me, but then my first duty station was Corpus Christi, Texas, and my next duty station was Memphis, Tennessee. So two impactful things, three I could say happened. Corpus Christi, Texas, the only integrated high school football team in the city of Corpus Christi, won the state championship in football. And some of the players I followed throughout, one of them went to Missouri and then played for St. Louis when they were in St. Louis. And the other team that won the same, the Corpus Christi, won the championship that day, and that night, Corpus Christi Coles, which was the black high school, won the state championship in their division that night, that same day. And that was in a time when it was in transition. There were places you went in, but there were still restaurants and counters you couldn't eat at. And there was movies you could go to, but you had to sit in the balcony.
That
was in Corpus Christi.
In Corpus. What about Ypsilanti during that?
Everybody went to the show. So it didn't make it was a difference. They had a balcony, but we weren't restricted to the balcony. Mm-hmm. The main thing I remember, and this window's still there, but it's disguised. Habs had a great thing called Chicken in the Rough takeout thing. But there was a window in the front. We couldn't go in. You picked up your order at that window outside. And so I never intended to go to Hobbs. I did a couple times because the family and friends wanted to go. And I did another time because it was Good Friday. And four of us guys who were veterans decided to go have a steak dinner because the family was doing something else. And we were on our own that Friday. So we all went to Hobbs, and my one buddy who was in the Air Force in Europe and had spent time in France, all of us ordered the T-bone steak with the sides. And then when the guy said, "Do you want wine?" And my buddy Richard says, "Yeah, I want so-and-so, such and such a year." And they took care of that. And so...
Now, you mentioned on the football team this Chinese person. Were the schools segregated at all?
Only in a sense that you still had neighborhood schools. And I still got the blurb that my dad cut out the paper. If you go to Ypsilanti, you got the old Brown Chapel AME Church. And next to that is a thing that says Adams School. And then next to that is Lucille's Funeral Home. Well, that school was Army Barracks in the 1800s. Then it became Adams Street School for the black kids on the south side. Then in 1919, the NAACP had the school condemned. And they built Woodruff School, which is now some kind of academy down on Michigan Avenue, across from where the old state police post used to be. Mm-hmm. That was Woodruff School. That built that for the kids on the south side. Then, sometime after that, years after that, because they had friends that still went to Woodruff School because they lived that far on that side of Ipsy. And then they built Herod Street Elementary, which was the school I went to after St. John's. And that was one of the best things that ever happened. Because we not only saw the first-rate movies on, if we wasn't bad some of the times, we didn't get to see them, I would say myself, and maybe a friend or two. But that was one of the things was Mr. Beatty would show the feature films that we saw, that a lot of them you'd see at the show, but we got one a week. And that's when I first saw the Tuskegee Airmen. And we didn't know how historic it was until years later, and we start going through our memory bank and then, you know, and then they start showing what people have done. And then I didn't realize my Boy Scout master, Louis Freeman, was a Tuskegee Airman. He was my Boy Scout master. And one of my other Boy Scout masters, Mickey Robeson, he was on the Red Ball Express. He got the Bronze Star for whatever he did for that. And so that's when other things come back, you know, when you think about these people. Mm-hmm. And but that was, he showed that. He showed when they had, he had a day where he gave out toothbrushes to the kids. And when you see the films of us as kids, we were a scruffy lot, as they say. But I mean, some of the kids that became All-Americans and all of this stuff are in those pictures getting their toothbrush. And
now, because the neighborhoods were segregated, so the schools were. So
we had a few people of color on the north side. And but basically, if you're basically east of or south of Herod Street and on Hawkins Street, you went to Herod Street Elementary. And that was like, so that was when I learned things that I wouldn't have learned if I'd have went to another school, because they would not have showed the Tuskegee Airmen in their gymnasium to all the kids on the movie day. Yeah. Then we took our pennies for savings bonds through the war bonds. Every kid, we brought pennies to school to get a war bond. So,
how did you get to school? Did you
walk? Everybody walked.
How far, like elementary, did you walk to school?
Everybody walked.
No buses.
If you lived in the city limits, you walked. Okay. If you lived outside the city limits, you rode the bus. So, like, if you can take, not Ellsworth, but Hewitt, anybody west of Hewitt rode the bus. Everybody east of Hewitt walked to school. But the school was right dead in the center of the city. So, in fact, it was called Ypsilanti Central High. And then they had a Central Elementary on the first floor until the school expanded and they built another elementary school out there on Forest and North Adams, I think. It was.
So how long did it take you to walk to school? I mean,
for me, it was about less than 15 minutes. Oh. But the kids that were coming from Watlin, next to where I-94 is, by the time they got to me, they were rolling. I couldn't keep up with them.
Now, you mentioned a restaurant where there was a separate pickup
place. Yeah, that was Hobbs.
Place.
That was Hobbs,
okay. And so what about when black visitors came to town? You know,
probably the same as everywhere else.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay.
We had, and back then it was kind of, we were talking about it the other night. We were talking about when I was growing up, you played softball in the sandlot, but baseball was what you played when you went to the park to watch the game. And some of these guys that played baseball, they played for Thorn Tire when they played baseball, which was a hardware place and auto repair place in Ipsy. And then when they played that at a championship level, and then when they got too old to play baseball, they were still able to play softball at a championship level. And one of those guys in softball used to bunt to get on base, and that's almost unheard of in softball because the field is so short and the game is so fast. But he could bunt himself on base.
So were these integrated teams, or were they?
Probably some of them were.
Some of them were.
And some of them weren't.
Weren't.
And most of the ones that we went to watch weren't. So.
Okay. This next section is about your adulthood and marriage life. So, and covers a pretty long period from the time you completed your education and entered into the labor force and started a family until your children left home and your spouse retired. So we might be talking a little while here about and asking a question. So after you finished high school, where did you live?
Well, I went in service after that.
Went to the service.
Well, I went to school for a year, and then I came back, and then I went to the service. And then I came back, and I worked at Ford's, Rawsonville. And then in December 65, I bought the house, my first house. And that's where I was staying when I got married. And that was, it was interesting because I had a friend and she asked me while I was there, because I had a couple bachelor buddies rooming with me and I didn't have any furniture except for my bedroom suite and the kitchen table and stuff. And I got six great big throw pillows and put in the living room because it was carpeted. And everybody had to take their shoes off when they came in the house. So, but I was advised, the young lady said, "Are you ever planning to get married?" And I said, "Well, maybe someday." She said, "They don't buy no furniture." And I said, "What do you mean don't buy no furniture?" She said, "Because if you get married, you don't live in the house. You fish and hunt and stuff like you do now, don't you?" I said, "Yeah." Say, "Then she lives in the house. Let her fix the house." I said, "Good idea." And that's what I did.
So how did you meet your wife?
I was home on leave, and had friends at Eastern and at university, and we were at a fraternity function or a sorority function, but I met her at one of the functions, and then I corresponded with her off and on while I was in the service, and then I lost track of her, and then one day I was in Ann Arbor. At a place, should be a place called the Town Bar, and they had jazz there, and we used to go hang out over there and listen to the music. And I ran into her there. They were celebrating the graduation of one of her friends from nursing school. And then that's how we reconnected, so.
So you reconnected, and then what?
Well, then things took their progression, you know. We started dating, eventually we got married, and you know, she took me to meet her grandparents, I still laugh when I think about it, cause Big Daddy says, he walks at me and says, "Son, do you drink?" I says, "Yes, sir." He went and he put a pint of whiskey, a shot glass, and a beer in front of me. And I said, "Thank you." And he said, "Now, you may not be able to handle my kind of whiskey, but that's all I got." I said, "Yes, sir, thank you." And I drank my shot and my beer. And when we left, Gloria, that's my wife's name, she said, "He never did that for none of my other boyfriends." And I said, "I'm not your other boyfriends."
So was your wife from Ipsy?
And she's from Detroit.
Oh, she's from Detroit, okay.
Yeah. And where she grew up at before they moved, I had a friend. She lived on Vinewood. And I had a friend of the family. Me and her son were good friends. So some summers I would spend a week or two down in Detroit with him. And he lived on Vinewood down the street. And it just one of those things we never would have met, you know, at the time. But she was near Grand River. And we were near the first cross street when you come around the boulevard from Grand River. And then that cross street there, we're a block off of Grand River. And you remember all of those things. You still had the neighborhood stores and you know. Mm-hmm. And then the boulevard was a playground. You could play for miles on the boulevard, on the center part.
So what kinds of things did you do on while you were dating? What did you all do?
We went bowling. We went to different functions. And basically just, did the things you do when you're courting, we went to different things, went to clubs, and I like jazz, so we went to different jazz clubs in Detroit and for the music and stuff. Mm-hmm. And
so did you get married in Nipsey or Detroit?
Detroit. Yeah.
And what was that like? How was the wedding like?
The wedding was great, but by the time we got out of the greeting line or whatever you call it, the rest of the family had ate up every grocery in the church. So if moms hadn't cooked that day, I might not have ate that day. But they had ate up everything, including the wedding cake. The only piece we got was the one that we took the picture with.
Oh, that's funny. Let me see. You want to tell me about, you said you had one child, did you say?
Yeah.
You want to tell me about him?
Well, we took him. He went everywhere. Basically, I took him when I went fishing. When he was older, I took him up to deer camp and just try to do as many things as you can, with the guys and what we do. And he learned what, I'll put it this way, he was shown how things got done and what you had to do to get them done. And sometimes no matter how you teach them, they don't follow up on it. So, but he had moments that just were, he'd always say something sometime. I asked him one time, I think he caught a sheephead one time. And I told him, we're fishing with artificial bait 90% of the time.
Sheephead, that's the kind of fish.
Yeah, that's the kind of fish. It's not one of the world's favorite, but it's what they call a freshwater drum. And so he caught it. He says, can I keep it? I said, sure. So we came back and I was fixing lunch and I filleted it out and then I cooked it and he's eating that and then he ate a piece of that. He says, Dad, is this sheep head? I said, yeah. He said, well, it don't taste good as the other. I said, yeah, well, what do you do? He says, well, you throw them back. And he got ready and then he stopped up and he says, or you save them, give them to somebody that likes them. I said, nah, you got it. See. You wasn't thinking about yourself. I said, I got a chance,
So you went fishing with him. What kind of other things did you do?
Well, whatever. If he wanted to do it, he went bowling. I took him. He had the bowling things where he had the little kids. He would take them to the bowling alley. Mm-hmm. And I'd go with him for that. And whatever function they had, I would. When he was in the Cub Scouts, he had to make a little Cub Scout derby, and he had to make a car. And they're looking at all these designs. I says, let me show you something. I says, all you got to do is, you got a block of wood, right? He says, yes, sir. I said, cut the back off here, cut the front down here, put the wheels on it and paint it. So that you got a streamlined looking car and you did nothing major. You got no, because they're supposed to do it themselves. And I know 8, 9, and 10 year olds, you're not going to be a craftsman type thing on there. So he did that and he still got it. It's, the wife looked up one day and there was the wife had put it in the drawer. So it was still there.
Did you have any kind of family traditions that you created, you and your family?
We didn't other than that 4th of July barbecue. Mm-hmm. That was all, everybody in the family looked forward to that.
To that. Mm-hmm.
So that. And then when I had got my own place and moved out, I would, I used to get season tickets to Michigan's game in Ohio. And when it was off season and they were playing in Ohio, me and my mother would watch the game together. And I would cook dinner, and then we'd have us a pint and a six pack, and we'd watch the game and eat dinner. And I remember one time I had a little garden, so I had all fresh stuff in there. And I don't know what kind of meat we had, but I had turnip greens fresh out the garden. Then I had the turnips steamed in butter, and Mom started eating, and she ate three helpings. And I said, Mom, you know what you did when I had three helpings at your house? She says, yeah, I put you behind out. I said, well, you just ate three helpings. She said, yeah, but I'm your mother, and you can't put me out. So, but I was good. Any time you can cook for your mother, son, you'd made it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Did your son go to school in Ipsy?
He went to school there, yeah. Okay. And that's when I looked at the curriculum they had, and I'm saying, man, you know, it's... there's no guidance in the curriculum that I could see. It was just a list of stuff. Whereas each year before, it was categorized in what was in the class, what, you know. And those, and I hear different things, like they're talking about getting rid of literature and all that stuff. And I'm saying literature is the greatest thing you got, because when they teach literature, they don't teach you to ask you to read the story. They ask you, what was he trying to say with the story? And I said, what it does is, I said, I'll give you an example. I watched Reagan give a speech for an hour, and everybody's clapping. I said, he only did two things. He said, the Russians are spending all their money on weapons instead of, then he go through a list of stuff that we get, household goods and stuff like that, and local stuff. And then he goes through that for the end. And at the end, he says, so we're going to do the same thing. That's all he said, for an hour. We're going to do the same thing the Russians do. We're going to spend all our money on weapons instead of domestic stuff. And I'm saying, they clapped for a whole hour, and he only said two things. He could have said that in 5 minutes.
Oh, dear. How did your son fare in Ipsy school system?
He didn't do as good as he could. Mm-hmm. The kid has, I don't know if he still got it, but at the time, he had almost like a photographic memory. Because mm-hmm. I asked him one time, what do you mean the teacher didn't? Oh, do you mean just this and this and this? Mm-hmm. I said, now, go to work. Mm-hmm. You know. Mm-hmm. But he would, I said, all I'm going to do is, I can make a chart. Mm-hmm. And all you do is tell me what you did today. And I'll tell you what's going to be on your report card. Then he didn't believe me. And when I told him, he said, well, how'd you do that? I said, I've been to school. I went to school. So I know what you're telling me and what's real and what's not, right. You know.
Okay, we're going to go to part four and talk about work and retirement. Some of these questions are fairly long, but part of your life, but I'm enjoying listening to you. From the time you entered the labor force, started a family, up to the present time. Okay. What was your main field of employment? How did you first get started with this tradition or skill? And what got you interested?
Well, what happened? Well, I started at the beginning. I worked at when I was in the Navy, I was not only electronics technician, but a two-year tour in Hawaii, where I played football for the 2 years I was there. But I still made my rate, and it's all competitive exams in the Navy. So I started up there because I had some wood shop experience, and it wasn't from the from training, but it was from the boys' club. So I knew a little bit about machinery, and when I went to the wood shop, we had a hobby wood shop, and all our wood came in the rough. It was 1x12 oak, 2x12 oak, 1x12 mahogany, and 2x12 mahogany, and they were actual that size. And we had to plane them down. We would plane one side off so the guys could look at the grain and see if they wanted that piece of wood. Well, then the shop chief showed me how to set up the planer, how to set up the edger, how to set up all the saws. So I knew how to set up all the shop equipment we had in there. And in that shop, we did anything from 8-foot sailing prams all the way up to inboard, outboard repairs, because we're in Hawaii. So there was a lot of boat repairs done by guys in the service who had boats over there, and they'd come there and have to repair them. And then we built them, and then we had one officer who actually designed, he was a commander, he was designing an airplane, and he did came into the wood shop to make the frames. And so I learned how to use the, you know, basically set up tools. And then when I went to Ford's, I was working at Rawsonville, and I got the job machining the housings for wiper motors and alternators. And I would also do the machining sometime for the brake housing reservoirs for your hydraulic brakes. And so I worked in different kinds of machining and checking in that area. And then when I left Rawsonville, I worked for a guy that made custom pallets. And all his wood came in, we got it in logs. And then we cut it into boards. And then he found out I could run all his machines. And he was basically retired, but he had that little machine operation. And so once I got there, he didn't have to do anything. But he couldn't afford to pay me what the job was worth. So that's when I came to the school system. And people asked me, why did you come to the school system working at the library? And I said, 20 days vacation and 10 days sick leave.
This was the school system in Ann Arbor.
Because the library at the time was under the public schools. Mm-hmm. So that kind of guaranteed their millage too, because whenever we needed something, they needed a little something, it was a package. And then Engler made them separated. So wherever you see a district library, that was Engler's doing to get school systems away from the libraries or vice versa. But the library was always a help to the school system. And that's why we were able to get, when I was driving the bookmobile and I'd go down to the bus garage, then because it was under the school system, then wherever the bus driver lived and where the mechanic lived, they could get an Ann Arbor library card. And so it worked great for all of us, you know, that lived out the district that were working mm-hmm. with the system.
So what'd you do with the bookmobile?
What we did was we went around the city and we did two things basically. Well, we were the outreach department. So the bookmobile was the primary. And so you went to areas where they're either new or there was no other services there. So a lot of neighborhoods, like on the west side, you have small houses and stuff. So that was new families. And so that gave them access to mainstream services in the city. In North Campus, the university, we had stops up there because that gave their family and their wives city services that they wouldn't get otherwise, because basically most of the time you got single transportation and you don't have time to make all these runs. And then you had we went to some of the old neighborhoods, because they were old neighborhoods and the people there were both, shall we say, self-contained money-wise, but a lot of them were seniors. So it was a great service to them because there was one, there was a bookmobile in their neighborhood. And what we did, being outreach department, we put a satellite library at the senior citizen. I forgot about that one I was talking about earlier. The senior citizen senior citizens building not West Park, but it's down here on Wells, where the
Burns Park.
And so the senior citizens, we had, they had a satellite library for them, so that not only did they have the live, the bookmobile service on one side of the park, but they also had a personalized service on the other side of the park. And we had satellite services like that at various retirement centers around the city. So that basically what happened was it gave the library real exposure and inform the public of what services are available. And we would always be able to say, if you need something, just call the reference desk. And whatever it is you need, if they have it, they'll send it out by us to you in the neighborhood. So that gave them basically hands-on access to the library without leaving their house except to pick it up. And those served out in the light. And another thing from the outreach department, you had not only the satellite libraries, but I mentioned it before, we had a traveling storyteller for the mom and pop's places, the little mom and pop daycare centers. And we had a separate library set aside for with picture books for all the daycare centers so they could borrow 30 books a month. It didn't have different picture books every month for the kids in their daycare center. And that was part of outreach services. Plus our entire, we had a separate, totally separate library. And what happened was we had a library and any books we had that the main library needed, then they just come to us and transfer it. Because they needed it in their circulation department. And that happened, and it was hard to explain sometimes that anything, it still belongs to the library, but we only keep, like especially the new books, we only kept them for 6 months max, and some we only kept for 3 months, depending on the readership and how much they read them and the size of the collection. Well, we told them, it says, all our books have to come back. They said, well, why don't you put them in the queue? I said, because our people can't get them. Well, they can sign up. I said, our people can't get them. We only have them for 6 months. If they're in the queue going all over the city, we don't have them for 6 months. And they couldn't understand it. Finally, one thing happened. We had a book that we got in January. The last time we checked it out was February. We got it back in July when somebody took it out of the queue and put it in the regular collection. And now we had physical proof that says it won't work. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Because those people that use outreach services, what they check out this week, they read. They never keep a book over 2 weeks. Usually 1 week and they're back for the next batch. And we put ours in the new books when they came out. We would spread them out so that we didn't put them all out the same day so that they would rotate through the collection, but everybody had a shot at the new ones in rotation. And it worked great.
It worked out.
Keep it simple.
Keep it. So did you, how long did you work at the?
At this library, I worked 32 years, I think.
32 years. Did you enjoy the work? Did you like meeting the people?
It was fun. Mm-hmm. It was fun. It was the people that made your day. Mm-hmm. And me, I think his name was Rick Redding. We had a kid on the west side. His name was Smule. And we had a hell of a time pronouncing Smule. So we said, we had to get our mouth and every time he come, he'd say, Cool Smule, because it helped us pronounce his name. Mm-hmm. And He was a nice kid. He was a nice kid.
So what was your wife doing all these
She was
two
teacher
years
in Ann Arbor. She was a school teacher in Ann Arbor. She taught Scarlett Middle School, and she taught at the name of the school right now, but out on Packard, or between Packard and Washtenaw, east of
elementary school.
Carpenter, yeah, elementary school. I can't think. Oh, and she talked at the one in Pittsfield too.
Okay.
Pittsfield Panthers. I can't remember. Yeah, but that was this guy. I got one of the T-shirts.
What grade did she teach?
She taught elementary, and then she taught junior high school. Yeah.
Okay.
But she taught graduate classes at Eastern and at Jackson Community College at different times.
Okay.
So.
Now, when did she retire?
She retired in about maybe 5 years ago, I guess. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. Well, when you're thinking back on your working adult life, can you think of any social or historical events that had any impact on you?
Well, I think we had what we called, when I was in circulation, we had a thing called the Wednesday Night Ice Cream Club. And that ended up involving everybody that worked in the evening. And what happened was one day we're sitting there and he says, "Chuck, I sure could go for some ice cream right now." And I looked at the clock, it was 6:45. I said, "I'll be back in 15 minutes. So from here, you go down to the street that Fingerly's on, you go to Washtenaw Dairy, you come up Ashley, come back up William, to come back in the library, it's less than 15 minutes. So I went and got a half a gallon of ice cream. And somebody said, "Well, why don't we do this again?" And I said, "Okay, well, let's do it next Wednesday. You know, we do it once, we just have it on Wednesday night." And so that's what we did. We'd chip in, everybody, we'd get a couple half gallons of ice cream, and the shelvers got ice cream, we got ice cream, the youth department got ice cream, and anybody in the building working that wanted ice cream had ice cream.
So that was a social activity.
It became a social activity at the library.
So I was thinking about anything that was going on in the country historically, socially, that had any impact on you during the time you and your wife were working?
Not really. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was the same. It was a progression of things, mm-hmm. and they all happened in sequence, and you kind of just rolled that sequence.
Okay.
And you tried to teach people that you have to be ready to do something. Mm-hmm. And we were talking about sports one time, and I just happened to they had the Ken Burns thing on Jackie Robinson. They also showed a picture on there of my friend of mine's dad, named Wright, Richard Wright, but anyway, his dad's last name was Wright, and he was at Montreal with Jackie Robinson, and they did show him and Jackie Robinson in that sequence, and what we called him Hoss, and Hoss said, "You know," he said, "people thought that me and Jackie Robinson was roommates." He says, "I was in the room by myself. Jackie had Marguerite." But he was one of the great black pitchers back in the day. So in fact, he came up and stayed on the campground with us in Canada fishing one summer. And the next time I was down there, he says, "Man, I get this stuff all the time," talking about all the New Orleans style cooking. He says, "Cook me that stuff we had on the campground." And so I would cook dinner for him at his house, and go over to his niece's house and eat all the Cajun stuff.
Tell me what you think is the biggest difference in the main field of your employment from the time you started until now. What's the difference?
Well, there's two main things. One, in the system, in the library system, it has more. It has become more impersonal, more like I'd say business-like, because when I always told our drivers that we are a guest in the neighborhood because these people pay the taxes that pay your wages. And so they are always patrons. And when they come to the library, sometimes people would call them customers, and I would say, no, they're patrons because they pay your bill and everything we need in here. And so then, and if you want to call a library art form, then they're a patron of this art of library services. So they are not customers because they already paid for this. They're just coming in to share what they got.
Mm-hmm. So it's different now than
well, then. They did that. I watched two phases of changes. I guess you could call them major changes, because one was in our jobs going overseas. And like when I was working at Ford's, they did the whole alternator. They had a section of electronic section. They're all American components, and they're all American made right there at Rawsonville. And one summer we came back from when they had what we call when they would redo everything in the plant. So you start with your new stuff and whatever you got next year. And they had two guys in the back, and one would take that section, put it on a tester. If it worked, he'd put it in this box. If it didn't work, he'd put it in that box. So all those people that were working there at that time are gone. And then from then on, it just kept going. Jobs kept leaving. And this was in back in 67, 68, somewhere in there, 69. So the jobs were leaving here then. And you look around, and all the little machine shops that used to be up and down the street that made parts for these small plants, they went too. So we don't, you know, so that was, and so our so-called manufacturing base, we don't have a manufacturing base anymore, because you don't have all those machine shops that used to support our manufacturing base is gone. Most of them are gone. You don't see them. And they were all over the place. And you'd see this little machine shop there and that machine shop there. You don't see them anymore.
Yeah. I may have asked you this in a different way, but I'm asking again. What did you value most about what you did for a living?
I think I valued most was getting people to use the resources that the library has. Because in to explain to them nowadays that when you check a book out, that guy is responsible for everything he says. And in the back of the book, they have a bibliography. And everywhere he got his information is stated. When you get something off the internet, he don't do nothing. He just says what's on his mind. And if you believe it, you hit, because he got no backup. And I said, that's why I saw, and another thing that was, when I saw that on that Jackie Robinson thing, they were telling about how when he first broke into baseball, they wouldn't mention that he was on the team. They would give the box score, but they wouldn't tell who he was. And I said, what I learned in history by being at the library was that when I look at history of U.S. involvement, and we talk about the Tuskegee Airmen, the unit's not mentioned. You look at Air Force history, they're not in there. You look at Army history, not in there. And if the unit is mentioned, it doesn't tell who it was. So I tried to look up the tankers. Was it 761st, I think it was. And you can't find them. You have to look, you have to go back in the index to start your research in a book. And if you're a person of color, you look for Negro, colored, mulatto. You use keywords to see where there's a reference. Mm-hmm. And what I learned about, I heard a guy one time, one of the Detroit announcers, they were talking about Black History Month. He says, I don't even see why we need a Black History Month. And I said, I agree. It should be taught all year because history don't evolve that way. When Ken Burns did his baseball history, he did the history of baseball as it grew. So he told what was happening in baseball with the Negro Leagues, with the Indian Leagues, with the Jewish Leagues, with everything as chronologically through history. And history's not taught like that. If it was taught chronologically what each person did in this in the country, you wouldn't need a Black History Week.
If they were included in the...
Yeah. Mm-hmm. He did, but and another thing they did by working at the library. There's a book called The Doughboys, History of World War I. And in it, there's about 14 pages of what the Black GIs did in World War I. And there's another book condensed for schools. And he took the 14 pages out. So in order to make racism work, you've got to keep everybody ignorant. Did anybody else contribute it? Because that way, they got no record, you know.
So. Tell me how your life changed when you and your wife retired. What was different?
When I retired, I got a chance to do it. I told guys, I said, all I'm doing now is I got all day to do the stuff I used to have to come home to do before I could go fishing. Now I can get it done and go fishing anytime I want to. I said, that's the only real difference. Psychologists, if they, you know, everybody's not supposed to be around somebody else all the time. Sometimes you need to just go sit off in the corner and air out for a day. And so you get more chances to do that. And I was trying to, what I did when I retired, first I cooked every day. I cooked everything, all the meals, all that. And one day she came home and I was sitting there, I'm dressed in my house shoes in front of the television. And she asked me, what did I do today? I said, nothing. She said, that's what I thought. You ain't did a darn thing all day. I said, excuse me? I said, let me tell you something. I did nothing all day just as hard as I could. And that's your first lesson on retirement.
So. Oh, dear. Okay. This is the last part.
Oh, wait, well, since you're talking, finish that up too.
Okay, go ahead.
Was that when she retired, and the guy said, both of you retired? I said, no, she retired. I'm under new management. So it was a different thing, you know. And that's all I do. They said, man, who cut the grass? I said, I work for the lady in the house, man. And so whatever she say do, I do it.
Okay. You all do have some fun, though, right?
Oh, yeah. I had...
Okay, now our last part. Tell me how it is for you to have lived in this community. What do you think?
Well, I've watched it both grow in the sense that we're getting more people of color in responsible positions. I've watched it grow in law enforcement, where we have more people in color in responsible positions. But the undercurrent, and going by our past election, is that we haven't grown much at all, because I think the country regressed, because he didn't, basically he hadn't done anything to prove that he's going to do anything. And the second, he's promised things that are impossible to do. There's never been a wall that anybody couldn't cross or go under or go around. Mm-hmm. So that's ridiculous. Mm-hmm. And to say that people from this country or that country can't come here because of this, especially if you base it on religion, it's basically unconstitutional. So he can't get where he got to. So in far as promising to bring jobs back, as I said, you got mm-hmm. to have a base, and jobs go from the base up. They don't come from the top down. And so that bringing jobs back, that's especially when Ford just said they're going to export more jobs. And that means right then, fundamentally, anybody that's a businessman should know the poor don't pay the taxes. The middle class pays the taxes. And if you don't have, and Ronald Reagan spent that middle class base money on outspending the Russians into the ground. And so when you don't have jobs from the ground up, you got no base. So all those people and all those jobs that left here are taxes that this country's not getting. You're destroying your own ground, you're destroying your own house from the ground up. And it makes you wonder. I say, look, you see that? That was a farm field. See the building houses on it. You can't eat a house. Build a house where you can't live. You know, where you can't grow groceries on it and stuff. But that's another subject.
Yeah. Okay. When thinking back on your entire life, what important historical events had the greatest impact, social historical impact, had the greatest impact for you?
Well, I would say probably the historical impact for what it did for this country would be the life of Martin Luther King. Because he didn't say us children, them children, those children. He said all God's children. That takes care of that.
Mm-hmm. Okay. What would you say has changed the most from the time you were a young person to now?
It's kids having Christmas every day. Because it lowers their incentive to really achieve, to have something. And I grew up when Christmas came once a year. Mm-hmm. You had all the stores would have a toy land that Christmas. And after that, when Christmas was over, it was springtime. So you had roller skates, kites, jacks, tennis, baseball, softball, bicycles, wagons, scooters, all that came out from the warehouse. And that was there for the summer. As soon as fall came, near fall, then it was football time and basketball. And sleds and skis and ice skates. And that was it. It wasn't a house full of junk. Mm-hmm. Because I'm kind of like this. If you're not going to use it or it's broke, then put it in the trash. Because most of the guys I knew, basically you got maybe one toy for Christmas. And you had to pick it out. And that's why I still had most of my toys were still in the house when I went into service, because I only got one a year. Mm-hmm. So those that I valued the most, one I still have, because I needed a special carving set to make model airplanes. And I still got that. I think back in the 50s, early 50s, or somewhere between 1949 and 51, that thing was $18. And that was a lot of money back then. And I still got that whole set, and I'm still using that whole set.
You're still using it?
I'm still using it. I got my wife on because she started borrowing my cutting tools to do stuff with her hobbies. I said, okay, here's your own.
What advice would you give to the younger generation?
I would say get off the computer and get outside and let the air blow on you. Because it's like I was saying, when you sit down in TV in front of TV, you get nothing done. Mm-hmm. Even stuff you might just simple to do, you get nothing done. And what I do, and I got it from patrons, was to I get my stories on CD, or back before CDs on tape. And what I did at first was I went through all the old classic books that they still had. And I read all the old classics while I'm working around in the garage because I got my hands free and I can listen to them. If I miss something, I can go back and get it. And I still, now I still do that now, but I'm not as much history because the new history, I'm here. So I'm not looking at it. But that was the best history. But it's the best way that I can spend my time productively. While listening to something, you can't do it with TV. Mm-hmm. And I learned, and some of those things, my buddy, years ago, he read, wrote Frankenstein. Mm-hmm. Anyway, listened to it, he says, man, he says, it's a story, not only a story, but the use of language in the story, you know? And this was a guy you would think didn't read classics of any kind, but he was. And so I read it, and it was great. I said, okay. So, you know, you just get into, it's just more productive. Mm-hmm. And I had one thing I got. It was a Western about this Englishman and his family traveling west, and this guide and his Indian chief buddy who went to Carlisle School, and one day his buddy was reading the Bible. And he looked at it, he says, can I read that? He says, sure, when do you want it? He said, well, I'll bring it back when I'm done. He said, okay, go ahead and take it. So a couple of months later, he brought the Bible back and gave it to the guide. He says, what'd you think? I said, it's a great story. He says, soon the white man believe in it, I'll recommend it to my people. I said, wow. I said, okay. You think, that's why I tell guys, I don't support a specific ministry. I support my buddies, you know, when I at the church and stuff like that. But as far as I says, I got too many friends. Mm-hmm. And if I went to a friend's church, I couldn't go to every church all day Sunday because all of them ain't open all day Sunday. Then I'd be all over town going to church. I said, now sometime I can help somebody or I can help somebody here, I'll do what I can, you know. Because mm-hmm. I fixed a friend, I went to the phone line, was bad, and I went in and fixed the phone line, showed him what was wrong, showed him what the part looked like, and he introduced me to the preacher, and we were talking. He says, well, why don't you come by on Sunday? And I said, Rhea, I work Monday through Friday, and on the weekend I either go fishing or hunting. I said, but if you need me to help you do something between Monday and Friday, you got me. Rev got up, shook my hand, said, nice meeting you. Because I'm going to give him what he need. See, he don't need me there on Sunday. If you need something done, then call me. I'll be there. Mm-hmm. And
okay, final question. How do you first personally feel about doing this interview and its impact on you?
Just give me a chance to run my mouth, but also share some history and some of the things that that can make life easier for you, you know, sometime. Mm-hmm. We did a little simple thing. We used to keep bookmarks, and we got a little budget at the circulation desk, and I'd go to the youth department, and they'd have these things that had all these different kind of bookmarks. So we'd get the ones that we know the kids would like, And so while the parent is up there checking the books out, the kid can pick out his bookmark. Well, that keeps them busy. And a lot of times that's the only thing they got to pick out when they got to the library, because the parents picked out all the books, so they get to pick out the bookmark. So that was one of the great things that happened. And sometimes you get kids that they don't sit in there and they just look at you and don't say nothing. And then they get the bookmark. And then there's one kid I remember, his dad was carrying her out and she looked back and she says, I said, now that kind of makes your day,
you know. Makes your day.
And you have fun with them. One kid was crying, he's up there crying, and I look at him. I said, what's that you got in there? And he started crying, and he closed his mouth. I said, open up, I didn't see it, let me see. I said, okay. So I learned a lot from kids like that. There was, I learned to keep it one-dimensional when you're telling them something. Mm-hmm. Because we used to give the kids an application. All they had to do is write their name and be able to print their name, and then they could take the application home, and parents would fill out and they'd bring it back, and then we'd get them a card, and then they could copy everything from then on. And we used to always say, fold it one time, and we'd fold it, and then they'd get to them, and they'd fold it again, and they'd, okay. Then I said, okay, we're the dummies. Give the kid the piece of paper. Say, now fold it one time and take it home. Boom. Mm-hmm. Now no confusion. No confusion. So keep it simple. Single digits and you got it. You know, you put too many moving parts in there and you're going to get confusion.
So. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Okay.